From the Progressive Radio Network in New York, this is Uncensored Live.
Good afternoon. I'm your host, Lee Stringer. Welcome to another edition of Uncensored Live. You know, the epitome of evil has always been, what we use as an icon of evil has been, is Hitler in Germany. And one of the phrases that has come out of that era is this. It's, all that is required for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing. And at the face of it, that makes a lot of sense. It's almost a truism. It's so simple in what it says. But on the other hand, it overlooks a few things. What that quote on the overlooks is the fact that very often evil comes cloaked in sheep's clothing, that many of the what happened to Germany was accepted by the people because it was put forth as being for their good. So that the fact is, it takes a lot of vigilance and rigor to discern the creeping incremental crawl towards evil. It's very seldom a conscious, let's be evil now. It's usually a series of small steps. And I say that because of our guest today and what we're going to talk about, which is yet another in a long series of laws that are being written under the guise of guarding against terrorism that bring us more and closer and closer to a less free, more governed, less tolerant state. And in this case, it has to do with what would seem to be an innocuous, relatively innocuous subject, and that is protection of companies that engage in what is called animal enterprise. Now, if you're not sure what that is, hang on 1 minute and we'll fill you in. Today's guest is Will Potter. Like most of our guests, he's an award-winning independent journalist, and he specializes in animal rights and environmental activism. He's written for several publications, including the Chicago Tribune, the Dallas Morning News, and Legal Affairs. And he has testified before Congress about his reporting. He's also the creator of Greens. Green is the New Red.com, where he blogs about the Green Scare and history repeating itself. Mr. Potter, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me, Lee.
I wanted to ask you something right off. You blog about the Green Scare? What is the Green Scare?
It's a term that a lot of activists and others have started using, making a comparison to what's going on right now of labeling environmentalists and animal advocates as terrorists and eco-terrorists to the Red Scare of the 20s and also the 40s and 50s. And there's just some eerie comparisons with a lot of other eras of government repression as well, but particularly with the Red Scare.
Very interesting that analogy pops up in light of my opening.
Exactly.
Because what was it the Reaganites called? The evil empire, the Reds. Now, before we get into this, I always ask my guests how they got onto the hook they're on. How did you get, did you start out as a journalist deciding to deal with environmental issues and this sort of thing, or did something happen that led you in that direction?
No, I just started out wanting to write for major newspapers and magazines. And when I was working at the, I had a grant to work for an independent publication called the Texas Observer that's been around for quite a while doing investigative reporting out of Austin, Texas. And while I was there, I did a story about a young woman who was convicted for a series of civil disobedience actions outside of fur salons. She was an animal activist. And as part of, she'd had, you know, four or five, six, I don't remember how many civil disobedience actions she'd done. They were all nonviolent. But the judge finally sentenced her to no protesting as part of her last civil disobedience. And so So I wrote a piece about her, kind of a profile, and also looking at, you know, this general buzz about eco-terrorism that was starting to come up in the late 90s. And it just really caught my interest, particularly because it was a merger of two things that I was very, that I wanted to write about, the environment and civil liberties. And since September 11th and since, you know, with Inconvenient Truth and global warming and everything going on, both of those issues, I think, have really just skyrocketed in terms of global and national importance, and they're really coming to a head and coming together with the type of work I'm trying to do.
Now, in the story that led me to you, which is about sort of an add-on to an already existing law regarding activism, particularly as it relates to animal rights, can we first sort of apprise our audience of what the 1992 law regarding this subject is before we get on to what's been added onto it, or how it's been strengthened?
Sure. In 1992, a law was passed called the Animal Enterprise Protection Act. And you probably, most of, or if not all of your listeners, have never heard of it. It didn't get very much attention at all, except from the corporations and the industry groups, the pharmaceutical and meat and dairy and fur industries that supported it. And what that did was it created this crime of animal enterprise terrorism for individuals. It was meant to go after people that are doing things like breaking into a fur farm and setting all the animals free, or breaking into a laboratory and rescuing or stealing beagles and other rabbits and things like that, and damaging equipment. And perhaps at the most extreme end of the spectrum is people that are using arson to burn down you know, logging trucks and bulldozers and forests and things like that.
So in reaction to the more brazen acts, they enacted a law.
Right, and it was meant to crack down on those more brazen acts, and it really sat on the shelf for years. It wasn't being used. The industry groups were not very happy about this, and then it eventually was used in 1998 and again in just a couple of years ago in 2004.
Tell us about the use of it in 1998. What happened and what was the outcome? Why did use...
That was the first use, and really it was in line with what the supporters said it was meant to do. There was a case involving two young activists out in the West Coast, and they released a series of thousands of mink from fur farms in five states, and they were eventually caught after being on the run for several years, and they were charged under animal enterprise terrorism.
So freeing animals is a terrorist act?
Exactly. And mind you, I'm not leaving out any, and people tend to, when I say this, they say, well, you're probably leaving something out. Did they hold hostages? Did they blow up you know, someone's home while they were inside? Did they hijack a plane or something like this? But that's simply all they did. They broke in. They didn't damage any property. They released these mink from fur farms, and that was it.
I don't see how that can be called terrorism. I mean, it eludes me. I mean, I'm sure it's economically harmful to a great degree. That no one would dispute. But how you go from that to terrorism?
Well, and I think really hit what is one key part of that answer is the economic aspect. Because if you look at a lot of what these groups are saying and these corporations and the fur farmers and the owners of these businesses, it's all about money. The animal rights and environmental movements, even with what most people would see as the most extreme elements of burning things down and using arson, which is very dangerous, a very serious crime. They have never harmed anyone, and they have, in fact, the government has recognized that they've taken lengthy precautions to avoid harming people. It's strictly been about sabotage. When you hear these groups talk about it, though, they say that makes it terrorism. These people are trying to terrorize them by using economic sabotage and destroying their property and trying to put them out of business.
Oh, I get it.
So there's
an abstract
blurring
argument.
Exactly. So it's a blurring of these ideas of most reasonable people would think of terrorism, especially since September 11th. There's one image that pops in your head for most people,
mm-hmm.
and that was the Twin Towers.
Mm-hmm.
And anything less than that, especially releasing mink from a fur farm, is just, to most reasonable people, it doesn't matter if you're vegetarian or, you know, drive a hybrid or you're a granola-crunching liberal, that's not terrorism. But they're really pushing the limits. Like you said in your introduction, this creeping, incremental creep step by step to push the limits of this war on terrorism.
Now, what happened to the group that was, were they convicted, and what was the consequence?
Well, and that is the second use of the law. That was just a couple years ago. And
mm-hmm.
again, keeping this theme going of this incremental creep, it was a group mm-hmm. of activists that ran a campaign called Stop Hunting and Animal Cruelty, that they were trying to put a controversial animal testing laboratory out of business. It was an international campaign. And it's very controversial because, one, they're not just trying to organize a boycott. They're trying to put this company completely out of business. And secondly, because they're vocally supporting people like the other activists I mentioned, people that are doing illegal things. They're not doing it themselves, but on their website, they have a very tongue-in-cheek, kind of snotty tone about all of this. And anytime a window is broken or an animal is freed or stolen from a laboratory, they are very, very supportive. And the government argued that created a conspiracy to violate that existing law, the Animal Enterprise Protection Act. Now, so with the first group I talked about, they actually broke in and released the mink. With the
mm-hmm.
second group, they're accused of conspiring to create a climate that contributed to that, that contributed to harassment, intimidation, and animal enterprise terrorism.
Wow.
And they were convicted.
It's a collateral thing.
Exactly. It's this idea of these groups have created this term called tertiary targeting. And
tertiary.
What that means, think of the anti-apartheid movement, how a key part of that movement and the anti-apartheid campaigns wasn't necessarily going after, you know, apartheid regimes. It was going after businesses that did business with those countries. So it was going after not
mm-hmm.
the direct target, but getting to them through other means, through tertiary means, as they call it. And these animal groups are doing the same thing. They're going after investment companies, after banks that invest in these animal labs. And because of that, these groups are saying that is a form of terrorism as well.
Well, wait a minute then. If we disagree with a sovereign country and we put sanctions in place, aren't we then as a nation guilty of terrorism under this definition, or is it only specific to this industry?
And that's the key point. It is only specific with this law and this new law as well to animal enterprises.
So I
obviously
can do
within
that,
the United States.
I can do the same thing against Kmart, for instance, with impunity, but I can't do it against animal enterprise.
Absolutely. Or another example would be, you know, we're talking about animal research and animal laboratories like in these campaigns. Let's say a spouse of an animal researcher decided to go into his or her office, vandalize it because they found out, you know, he was being cheated on, vandalize the office, release the animals, destroy the research just out of a, you know, vindictive rage. That would not be terrorism. But if an animal activist did the exact same thing with the exact same results and the exact same amount of damage, that would be terrorism.
So this falls
simply
down
because of the intent.
So this falls down as a law that, in essence, wants to stifle dissent in a democracy.
That's what I would argue. I think that is clearly the intent, is not to go after the people that are actually committing these crimes, because they're already illegal. And these people already know that they're illegal, and they already know they're facing serious jail time. I think the purpose of using the word terrorism and being so vague and pushing the limits and creeping, as we've been talking about, is to instill fear and to make everyday people afraid of being labeled a terrorist and, you know, keep them at home and not acting on their beliefs.
Now, one thing, what were the sentences, what were the penalties imposed upon in the case of 1998 and 1992?
And that's another interesting point. In 1998, both of those activists got about 2 years in prison, and I'm talking about the ones that actually released the animals from the fur farms. And then, you know, the other activists are serving prison sentences right now. On the high end, about 7 years, and on the low end, of 1 year. Most of them are in the middle.
Wow.
Vocally just supporting, using First Amendment activity to support illegal action, in essence, got more jail time than actually doing the crime.
Doing it. Wow. That's that creeping thing. Now, we haven't finished yet, because that was the old law that was in place. Now, as draconian as that seems, somehow people didn't feel that it was enough.
And right.
Yes. But before we go there, let's go there, then I'll ask the question. So what happened next? Do you know why? Was there a precipitating event that led somebody somewhere to open the books again and says, gee, we got to toughen up this law?
Well, as soon as that original law passed in 1992, these corporations and these industry groups were saying exactly that. As soon as the law passed, they were already advocating for stronger sentences, stronger language, more inclusive definitions of terrorism to wrap up even more animal advocates. And so the law was expanded mildly again in 96 and 2002 with just very minor changes, in my opinion. But it sat on the shelf again, and these groups wanted more and more expansion. And I think they saw their best opportunity to finally do that in, you know, just a year ago last month, when Congress was about to shift. They're going into the November elections. There's a very big concern by a lot of people that the Democrats would take control. There's a perception that it would be harder to get a new law in place with the Democrats in control, and so they really put all their effort into getting this law passed.
So the AEPA, which is the Animal Enterprises Protection Act, became the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. Is that
right.
what you refer to?
Right, exactly. And it's,
and what?
Mm-hmm. Well, and the key things it did, I mean, in my opinion, the original law was already vague and already extremely broad, as you can see how it wrapped up people as terrorists for releasing mink from a fur farm and also running a very controversial website, but a website nonetheless, and being convicted of conspiring to promote terrorism. But this new law is even more broad, even more vague, even more ambiguous, and has even stiffer sentences. So it is really ratcheting up this foundation that has already been laid and really pushing the limits of what is terrorism.
Well, and also I understand, according to your article, it greatly expands the definition of animal enterprise itself to include most U.S. businesses. It says any enterprise that uses or sells animals or animal products.
Right. And there is no qualification on that statement. In the definition section, it doesn't say any enterprise that has 80% of its business from animal products or animal skins or something like that to try to narrow it, which I still think would be inappropriate, but it would try to narrow it. But like you said, it's not only any business that sells any animal product. It's any business that does business with a business that sells animal products. Because remember what I was talking about, tertiary targeting. And that's actually spelled out in this new law, that any individual or business that has any ties to an animal enterprise, if you target them, that can be animal enterprise terrorism.
Now, does
so
it
you're
specif-
effectively...
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Does it specify what you must target them for, or just that if you target them? I asked this in this case. Let's say I go to Macy's. They sell any number of things that have, you know, an animal origin in the store. And let's say there's a bed banister, you know, and I trip and they don't fix it, and I go on the internet and say, don't shop there, look at this, you're going to hurt yourself. It has nothing to do with animal activism. Could I be prosecuted under that law because they happen to, you know, do business with people who use animal enterprise?
I don't think so in that case.
Oh, good.
But the law, that is good. Except that
we're safe to sue Macy's, okay.
You're safe to sue Macy's. However, you know, if you were using those web forums and your internet comments as part of a campaign, and according to the language of this law, for the purposes of interfering with the operations of an animal enterprise. That's what the law says.
I see.
And as part of that, if you intentionally damage or cause the loss of any property, which could include the loss of profits, or if you put anyone in reasonable fear of harm, which isn't defined.
So, okay.
In other words, if you do either of those things, which are so ambiguous, I mean, it could include the loss of profits, and it's hard to talk about reasonable fear when we're in this post 9/11 world where these activists are being labeled as terrorists all the time.
And fear of what? I mean, fear of a stockholder's fear of not getting a less of a payoff in the quarter. I mean, you know.
Well, it's fear of, as it says, fear of bodily harm.
Oh, a bodily harm. Okay.
Which, again, considering these, even the most extreme of these individuals in these groups have never harmed anyone by the government's admission, I don't really see where that comes into play. I think that part of the law is clearly meant to go after, for instance, here's a scenario I think could really come up under this law and was part of this SHAC campaign as well. If you have a group of activists, they're holding a legal demonstration outside of either a CEO's home in the suburbs or a corporate office downtown. They have bullhorns, they're chanting, they're very loud. Some of them are wearing masks or bandanas, which is increasingly common in all types of protests because people are so afraid of being on these terrorist lists and having FBI files and all this kind of stuff. Well, you know, if you have a group of people that are loud and some of them have masks outside of your office, I mean, someone could argue that's creating a reasonable fear. That's making you afraid.
I feared for my life. Masked men are congregating around
exactly.
My house. How do I?
Where it's clearly legal and they're not going to harm anyone. They're holding signs. But I think that could easily come under the purview of this legislation.
Okay, here's the question that's on my mind. Okay, so I'm an animal activist. I do what's fundamentally legal, but they grab me and prosecute me or brand me a terrorist under this statute. Now, from there, am I branded? Am I treated the same way as any terrorist would be treated? And according to other legislation, they can do pretty much anything they want without any legal representation for you. I mean, once you're labeled a terrorist, could that happen, and has it happened?
Well, to answer the first part of that, if it could happen, I mean, what we know, or what I know now through interviews and through my reporting, is that these so-called eco-terrorists and animal rights terrorists are in a weird in between. I mean, they're not a regular inmate, but they're also not being shipped off to Guantanamo or something like that, in part because they're U.S. citizens, and I think in part because these are largely white, privileged social movements, and, you know, the people being sent to Guantanamo and things like that are largely Arab American and Muslim people. But also, when these people are in prison, though, this activist Peter Young, who is one of the ones, the two who released Mink from a fur farm, he talked about having to wear a bright red jumpsuit, which indicated he was a high security risk. They're being sent to medium and maximum security facilities.
Well, he might release minks from prison?
Exactly.
It's in danger.
When he traveled, some of your listeners have probably seen that Hollywood movie Con Air. Well, there actually is a Con Air for convicts when you're transporting them. And he was one of only a handful of prisoners out of 100 on the plane that had to wear what's called a black box, which is a this black device covering your handcuffs for the most violent inmates. And he said, you know, the other inmates would turn to him and say, well, you know, what are you in there for, cheating on the SATs? Like, what? He was just this skinny kid getting the harshest treatment as a high security risk. So we do know that...
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. No, you go ahead.
We do know they're clearly getting some differential treatment. There's no doubt about that. But at the same time, the government doesn't seem like they're going, you know, for lack of a better phrase, no holds barred, and really like trying to ship people off and deny habeas corpus and things like that, deny access to attorneys.
Okay. Well, since we know that power grows, it doesn't shrink unless it's caused to shrink, and we're talking about an incremental creep. Let me turn the question around this way. Is there anything in the document, any legal term in the law that would prevent these people being treated at some point the same as any other terrorist?
Do you mean any kind of safeguard to prevent them from being...
I mean, they're not doing it, but is there anything, if there's any reason that they couldn't do this eventually? I'm not saying they are, but is there anything, any reason that once they're branded terrorists, is there anything keeping the government or the authorities from treating these people in the same way they treat all terrorists?
Well, I think if only the most modest safeguard, if you can call it that, is one of the key differences when you're talking about these animal rights and environmental activists versus, say, Al-Qaeda, is mm-hmm. the issue of citizenship. And we can see with the Jose Padilla and other cases going on right now that really isn't much of a protection anymore. But I think it is at least a modest differentiation between animal rights and environmental activists and so-called domestic terrorists versus international terrorism. As your listeners probably heard of rendition and the practice of sending terror suspects to other countries to be tortured and to have information gathered by other governments in these secret holding facilities. I don't necessarily foresee that happening with animal rights and environmental
activists. Well, I wasn't so much talking about that end of things as much as the fact that they can be held indefinitely without counsel or without being that sort of thing, because it occurs to me if it gets to the point where these activists get together and hire a powerful lawyer, that begins to unravel the unconstitutionality of this and whatnot, begins to be successful in adjudicating the cases, the next step would be, well, take him out of the equation.
Exactly, and I think that's a very real concern. I mean, I've been following this issue since about 98 or 99, and over that time, you know, these kind of tactics and these kind of crimes in the name of the environment are nothing new. And the government has a very hard time cracking down on this and putting an end to it. And so it's been escalating over this time. Now we have this new Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. And if that doesn't stop these illegal activities and legal activity, they will have to ratchet it up again. And I think there's just this constant back and forth. If these Shack activists win on their appeal, it is a victory without a doubt, but at the same time, I think the government and these corporations will have to push back and up the ante and try to do something new.
Okay, here's a huge question, because obviously, I mean, what I see here is this is my personal opinion that this incursion of corporate interests almost to the exclusion of the interest of the rest of the citizens has been constantly pressed forward. And I see this strictly as a corporate thing to make it easier for corporations to do whatever they do and continue to reap profits as a corporation is supposed to. Given that, why is it only in this arena? Why hasn't, you know, there are all sorts of things we protest. There's toxifying the environment. It has nothing to do with animal rights. Why isn't there a similar law, you know, being pressed in other industries? Why did it happen in the animal, what do they call it, animal enterprises arena?
Well, I really think there are, and I've wrestled with that a lot, and I don't think there's a simple explanation, but I kind of have three ideas that I think have contributed to it. And one would be that animal rights activists in the radical environmental movement are fairly isolated from, especially the animal rights movement, from larger social justice movements like the anti-war movement and feminist movement and things like that. There has been some divide. They're kind of isolated. They're kind of off on their own a little bit. They haven't really made a lot of connections with these other social justice movements too well. And I think the second part is the animal rights and environmental movements have been using this, they would call it direct action, directly intervening and using, locking themselves to bulldozers or vandalizing bulldozers and vocally supporting the people that are doing that. They've really been out front on that, I think, much more than, let's say, the anti-war movement has been doing. And I think really the third part of it, and which to me is becoming more and more persuasive as this continues, is that it's not just about corporate profits. I think that is a very, very big part of it. But I think this is also, in some ways, the proponents of this law and the proponents of this so-called eco-terrorism view this as a culture war. They really view it as these animal rights and environmental activists are fundamentally challenging Americans' right to eat whatever they want or wear whatever they want or drive SUVs and drive Hummers and buy extravagant homes in the suburbs made out of old-growth forests and things like that. If you look at their rhetoric, they very much view this as a threat to the American way of life, as opposed to like the anti-abortion movement or a group like that. And that's why I think this comparison to the Red Scare becomes really appropriate, because during the Red Scare, some of the comments people made, I mean, Mitchell Palmer in the 20s talking about how, you mentioned the Red Menace and just how it was just a threat to the American way of life and how it could erode American values to their core and just all this hyperbole. We're seeing a lot of that right now.
Now, here's the other question. Excuse me. How is it legal to concoct such an exclusive law? I mean, one that is, if it's based on any principles, you understand what I'm saying? If there are principles
right
behind it, how can those principles only be active in a specific scenario? How could that be legal? It seems to go against what laws are.
Exactly. And I think that was one of the concerns I raised when I testified before Congress. And partly in response to that, there's a section in the law at the very end. It says nothing in this bill should be construed to prohibit any conduct protected by the First Amendment to the Constitution, which even if you don't know much about Washington, D.C. and how Congress works, that's a very bizarre thing to say. It's kind of like saying, trust us, it's constitutional. It's admitting that the law has problems, and they're just saying, trust us, we're not going to take away your constitutional rights. Don't worry. But like you said, people should be very concerned.
Absolutely.
I think the only way the constitutionality of it will be challenged, I think, is through the courts. I mean, if people don't step up and fight this, it will stand, and the government will try to use it.
Now, a case in point, I wonder if this is a case in point and whether any of these laws entered the fray in this instance, but four, five, 6 years ago, Oprah Winfrey got into a whole brouhaha for basically stating the truth, and that is, and we know this to be true, that red meat eaten in great quantities you know, clogs the arteries and can lead to heart and other diseases. And for this, she was sued by the state of Texas, which passed its own law that you can't badmouth an industry. Now, here's a case where, when we're talking about free speech, where all she did was utter a truth.
Right.
That's all she did. And she was litigated against. Now, do your knowledge, did any of this, these laws come into play in that case?
And that's come up quite a bit talking about this. Oprah Winfrey and Howard Lyman was the cattle rancher she was interviewing. And I think, you know, it's kind of a touchy middle area. I wouldn't think that that kind of speech would necessarily be on the center of the target for the government or for corporations in using a law like this. But at the same time, I really don't see anything in the legislation that would specifically exempt something like that. I mean, like I mentioned before, there is that clause, nothing shall be construed to violate the First Amendment. Well, that doesn't really mean a whole lot if the government and you have an ambitious prosecutor arguing that, let's say, someone like Oprah Winfrey, or an even more foreseeable example would be somebody of much less stature.
Right.
Something in the government arguing that they intended to disrupt and interfere with the meat and dairy industry. Whereas Oprah Winfrey, perhaps she was just reacting. She wasn't trying to do something. She was just reacting and giving her opinion and giving statements of fact.
Right.
Well, if the government argued she was doing that as a, let's say she was an independent journalist, or she was someone trying to make social change, that would be a very different story. I mean,
I'm a doctor.
Go ahead.
And I have an internet site, and I warn everybody against eating a lot of red meat. And in fact, my intent is to encourage fewer people. I'm intending them not to eat as much red meat. Well, couldn't that be brought up as an intent to, you know, undermine the industry? What was the phrase you used? An attempt to affect
beer and right.
I mean, because as a result of that, I'm asking fewer people to eat it, which means fewer sales, which means so forth and so on. I mean,
And what holds me up on that, I mean, I want to say that based on I read this law all the time, I talk about it all the time, and my gut would be to say that I don't think the government would try to push it to that extent. But at the same time, I have to acknowledge that the law is so vague that, you know, it talks about intentionally damaging or causing the loss of any real or personal property. Well, to you or I, that may mean, let's say, you know, burning down a building or breaking laboratory research, something like that. But in the other sections of the law, it talks about the loss of profits. So it's this kind of ambiguity that really leaves open a lot of wiggle room for an overzealous prosecutor. And I think that's really the danger. If a prosecutor really wanted to make a test case and try to push the limits, you know, in this political climate, I think they could try to do something like that.
Well, that was, of course, my point. The point is, you know, if for nothing else, you know, however we might feel about, you know, animal rights and animal enterprise, I mean, it is definitely in everyone's interest to speak out against bad law that is simply bad because it's vague and open to broad interpretation and abuse. I mean, that to me is an underlying issue that's bigger than whether or not you're going to eat a Big Mac.
Oh, without a doubt. I think by far the most important thing about this law that everyone should know about, not animal activists, not environmentalists, I'm talking anyone who's just a citizen and has something that they care about, is that when we're talking about that creeping idea, this is a test, that the government is using this as a test to go after the most vulnerable, the most isolated, in some people's minds, the most extreme activists, to use these harsh penalties to push the limits of the war on terrorism. And once you set that precedent, then you can use the exact same type of law for other people. And so as a great example of that, one of these some corporations anonymously took out full-page ads in the New York Times and the Washington Post about animal rights terrorists, with a person with a black mask and holding Wall Street hostage and all this kind of rhetoric. And if you look on their website, they list other types of causes that they think could be a concern as well. They mention groups like the Communication Workers of America. They mention labor unions. They mention environmental groups like Greenpeace and the Sierra Club. I mean, very mainstream organizations that are being listed as potential terrorist threats. We were talking about in your introduction, you had mentioned people always think of Nazi Germany as like the epitome of evil. And I think it was Martin Niemöller had that quote about, first they came for the communists, but I wasn't a communist, so I didn't speak out. Mm-hmm. Then it was the socialists and trade unionists and the Jews, and then they came for me and nobody was left. And that just rings so true to me with what's going on with these animal rights and environmental activists. Because if you think, well, I'm not a vegetarian or I'm not an environmentalist, so why should I care? Well, pretty soon it's going to come home.
Yep. And then we all care about something. And one day they'll come for that, I guess is your point. And I can see it. I mean, to me, what happens in human events these days, with particularly as it regards political machinations and laws and things like that, is that they come on a one-by-one piecemeal basis, and the merits or lack thereof are argued singularly. Certainly on any news or other reportage in the mainstream, there's no linkage of a trend. Stringing these things together and saying, what is this leading to? What are we becoming? What is it mean? You know, it's just arguing each thing individually.
And I think a perfect example of that is recently the House of Representatives passed a bill called the Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorism Prevention Act. It's still pending before the Senate. It is not law yet by any means, but it's passed the House overwhelmingly. And if you view this law in isolation, I mean, it just seems like another bad bill. Hopefully it will be defeated in the Senate. But when you start pairing it with things like the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, which passed without a single member of Congress opposing it, not one member of Congress opposed that law. Now we have this Homegrown Terrorism Act that is, according to the supporters, meant to go after homegrown terrorism and anything that supports extremist belief systems. They're going after, you know, I hate to use Orwell too much, it's almost a cliche, but this is thought crime. They're going after extremist belief systems and ideologically based violence is what they call it.
And they, what is ideologically based violence except the war on terrorism? But anyway, I mean, it's interesting they say belief systems, so that I can see the lawyer Adam splitting there, because they're going to say, well, we're not telling you not to believe it. Just don't, you know, do anything effective. Don't actually share it or anything like that. You're free to believe anything, but don't a bunch of you who believe the same thing start getting together. And it reminds me of, you know, during apartheid, you referred to apartheid, where it was, if you were black in a 93% black country, you were not allowed to assemble. I mean,
it's kind of like you have free speech, just don't try to open your mouth.
Exactly the
message that's being sent.
Exactly, you know, it's similar to what under the Giuliani era, the whole idea of the homeless. And I used to tell people, the way it stands now in New York City, it's perfectly okay to be homeless as long as you're not homeless within 50 yards of another human being.
Well, with all this, it's just you got to laugh because it seems like it's getting to that point where you just got to have to, you got to ship people somewhere. Everybody's going to become a terrorist. Everyone's a terrorist threat, and you got to just sweep them under the rug somehow.
Well, it won't be everyone in the short run. Everyone who sort of agrees. I mean, what? Let's get down to it. Most of this stuff is you're safe as long as you agree with the current prevailing ideology. We'll put it that way. I won't even name a president or anything, but the prevailing ideology, which seems to be only focused on economic might.
Right.
I mean, and anything that interferes with that. And from the way I look at it, what I see is what this really in the, this is a country that's, in my opinion, in the last throes of empire. And to hold on, the last throes of empire always become oppressive as you use all the might you have to try and hold on to what you have, and it becomes impossible to do.
I think historically, too, of just more and more focus on, like you said, ideology, of concentrating, using available power to go after specific forms of dissent, specific belief systems. And I think that is really one of the big dangers of this, the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, this new homegrown terrorism act, is that when you start going after belief systems, it's so fluid. I mean, if or when a certain power structure changes, you have a precedent in place for the next group of people to abuse that power against someone else.
Exactly. And it's not just going after, it's not just the going after belief systems, it's the criminalization of it. That's a whole other step.
Right.
You know, I mean, yeah, of course you're going to defend a belief you believe in if someone opposes it, but to criminalize it, that becomes a whole different ballgame.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask you, you know, given this march towards this, what I would say is kind of insane, you know, insanity, how can our listeners, number one, educate themselves? Because, like you say, most of these things are passing under the wire. How can our listeners stay informed on this sort of thing, number one? And then number two, what can our listeners do collectively and as individuals in the choices they make to oppose it if they so wish?
Well, in the first part, I would say support your independent media and alternative media as often and with whatever resources you have. I run a website, greenisthenewred.com, which I update regularly with information solely on this issue and these issues. But there are a lot of other great media resources like your program, the Progressive Radio Network, publications like In These Times and Texas Observer, The Nation, all kind of the usual suspects, in addition to reading mainstream media outlets. But in terms of the second part, I always have kind of mixed feelings about talking at length about these issues because it sometimes has the impact of paralysis. I mean, it makes people so afraid or so frustrated, and this kind of fear and almost hopelessness sets in of, you know, things are going so downhill. You have this Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act and these new legislation and this seemingly never-ending war. But I think the most important point for me to try to say to other people and my friends and family is that I think there's a really fine line between fear and rage. And I think sometimes when you first hear about these things, you can be very afraid. And then once you start reading about it through websites and independent media and mainstream media, you start reading the law itself and learning about it and talking about it, that fear can, the information has the power of subduing that fear, and suddenly becomes rage. You become angry about it, and you become so angry and so enraged that you actually want to organize with people and do something about it. And I guess that is my—I don't have any specifics about.
And that's when you become a terrorist.
That's when you become a terrorist, exactly. Or then that's when you just say enough is enough. We've gone way too far, And I'm not encouraging any course of action here other than just talking to your friends and colleagues about this. And suddenly I think it has the effect of when you're talking to your friends and your family and people you care about issues like this, and you're all passionate about it, you suddenly find yourself doing things and organizing and speaking out and writing letters and calling reporters and things like this. And all of a sudden you're making change. I think that's the most important thing right now.
Very good. That makes sense. That makes a lot of sense to me. Talking about it, at least the let the dialogue. And I think this is so much a part of the problem is the great silence and secrecy that this stuff is being under which this is being done. You don't hear about it in the mainstream news. Nobody's talking about it over dinner. You know, and they go, well, look how easy we did that. Let's take the next step. Even if you can't roll back what's been done, if we are allowed and aware and express our dissent, they're not going to be so encouraged to keep going.
Exactly. And I think it's just been, I've really been shocked at how there's been virtually no either mainstream or even in the alternative press coverage of the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, and even now this homegrown terrorism bill. I'm not seeing anything about it, really.
Do you know what that provides for, this homegrown terrorism bill? Can you give us a little sampling of what it seeks to do?
Well, its purpose is equally vague to that Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, in that it's meant to go after so-called homegrown terrorism and domestic terrorism. It defines it as that violent radicalization of through promoting extremist belief systems. So it's really, the purpose is to start going after, like we were talking about, actually the criminalizing the thought, criminalizing the belief system. And it's really doing that through what all the predecessors to the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act were trying to do, in that it creates this government study of homegrown terrorism, and it creates a center to evaluate the problem. And that all sounds very innocuous and kind of boring and not much of a threat, and it's really not. It's not going to wrap up people and send them to Guantanamo necessarily. But when the government starts creating these studies and these investigations and these terrorist threat centers, all of a sudden you have a terrorist threat. It's like it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. You create an entity to investigate and to research a threat, and the entity, of course, reports back that there is a threat, and now we need a stronger piece of legislation. And to me, that's really the big concern about this bill, is setting that foundation. Once you have that foundation, you can start creeping, like we were saying, and rolling back those.
Once you get that database.
Exactly.
And we've been witness to situations where the database has been read to the convenience of a policy that the administration wants to push, just like the reading of the data of weapons of mass destruction. And I mean, once they have the data, my point is once you have these high-level investigators gathering information, who knows how they can be interpreted to whatever end? Interpreted to whatever end. So that's how you actually be studying it. It becomes true.
Well,
like you said.
A perfect example of that is since the 1992 Animal Enterprise Protection Act passed, there have been reports by, I believe they were by the FBI, on acts of so-called animal enterprise terrorism or animal rights extremism. And so these numbers have been batted around, and I've seen a range, but something like 1,000 or several thousand incidents since, 2002 or whatever date. Now, I'm not being specific with those numbers, but that's just the general area.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look into the actual data, it may seem like, wow, 1,000 attacks in a couple of years, that's really extreme. But the things that are listed as attacks are things like spray painting Go Vegetarian on a McDonald's, or breaking the window of a fur farm or something like this. Just minor petty vandalism that are being listed in a database of terrorist incidents And now the government says, well, we've had 1,000 incidents of animal rights extremism since such and such a date. We need to
stop. You know, when I go to a McDonald's and I see Go Green spray painted on the side of the wall, I genuinely fear for my life.
Clearly, because there is no greater domestic terrorism threat than that.
And you know, given what we've discussed, it is probably very likely under this new bill, this Homegrown Terrorism Act, that they will evoke the harsher treatment of, and possibly, well, you're a terrorist, you're homegrown, but you're a terrorist, you don't get a lawyer. You know, I mean, because that's much more potable to a populace that's afraid of terrorism.
And I think that is really just the key point of all of this. With all of this legislation, you know, it may or may not be used, but at the end of the day, the government, I don't think, should be given any power that you don't want them to abuse. That's really what this boils down to. If you create a law that is vague like this, you cannot be shocked when the government tries to use it and tries to push the limits.
Exactly. The bottom line is, never in history has a power been given that isn't then used.
Exactly.
And you can't guarantee the purity of everyone who will come down the pike who will have hold of that power.
Absolutely.
You can't. So you're setting up your own demise. Well, this has been much bigger than it sounded at the surface of things. It's not about the animal enterprise industry. It's not about the protesters as much as it's about another kind of incursion on what we have always trusted and understood as our basic rights as citizens of the United States. Mr. Potter, I thank you for joining us today. And for those of you out there, I thank you for listening this time, and I'll see you next time.